If that's okay. Been sitting down a lot recently, and it means you'll get a chance to see me a little bit better. I know what it's like sitting back there. And I think on my feet as well, which reminds me, I better get my notes out. I've just spent the last 10 minutes writing notes, which of course I now can't read without putting my specs on. Maybe I won't need them. What Barbara asked me to do, by the way, can you understand the accent okay? I know it can be problematic if there's anything I say and you go, what's he talking about? Just ask me to repeat myself. Barbara wanted me to talk a little bit about Scotland, about Scottish literature, maybe the Scottish crime novel, which is going through a golden age of its own at the moment. But to get there, I've got to talk a little bit about why Scotland has no tradition of the crime novel. Now, if you arrive in Edinburgh, how many of you have been to Edinburgh? Most of you, quite a few of you. Okay, fantastic. I started writing my books to try and show people that there was more to Edinburgh than bagpipes and tartan and the castle, stuff like that. That Edinburgh was a real vibrant, contemporary city. This was the 1980s, with real contemporary problems and political and social issues. And I thought the crime novel was a pretty good way of doing that. But I'd come to the crime novel through quite a circuitous route. I didn't read crime. I'm practically the only crime writer I know. I'm going to keep saying crime writer. We don't really say mystery writer in the UK. Every time you hear crime writer, think mystery writer. Not a writer who commits crimes, but a writer who writes crime. I'm about the only crime writer I know who didn't read crime fiction. I did grow up on comics, Batman and Superman and Spider-Man and lots of British comics as well, mostly, you know, boys' own adventure stories about, you know, armed warfare and stuff like that, and adventures in outer space with astronauts and aliens. All of that stuff I grew up with. And I grew up in a kind of blue-collar family in a coal mining village, or had been coal mining. The coal had run out by the mid-60s, so by the time I was 6 or 7, the jobs had kind of disappeared that used to keep the village active. So it was quite a depressed place. My parents were working class, left school at 15, got jobs in factories, or in my dad's case, at a dockyard. And there weren't many books in the house, but I was an insatiable reader from a very young age, and comics were cheap, affordable literacy. And I would get 5 or 10 of them a week and sit in my bedroom. But being a kind of I was a bit of a fantasist, so it wasn't enough just to read these, I wanted to write them as well. I would try and draw comics. I couldn't draw, but that didn't really stop me. I would get bits of paper and fold them in half, make little booklets, and then fill them up with squares and little stick people inside the squares and speech bubbles, and I put a free gift on the front to try and attract readers and show them to my mum and dad and nobody else. But you know, it just wasn't enough for me to be reading these things. I wanted to write them as well. And it was a really great library. It was a Carnegie library. Andrew Carnegie was born in Fife. I'm from Fife, Cardenden in Fife, where I grew up. Is about 12 miles from Dunfermline, which was Andrew Carnegie's birthplace. And so he'd given the money to lots of towns and villages throughout the UK, specifically Scotland, so people could have a library and have access to books. And I would haunt that place. One of the most exciting moments of my life was when they said, Ian, you can stop using the children's section now and go to the adult section. I was 12 years old. It was an exciting time. So suddenly I was getting access to things like The Godfather and Shaft. All these movies were out there that I wasn't allowed to see. In the UK, you had to be 18 years old to see these movies. But at 12, nobody stopped me reading the books. And I thought, literature is a really exciting thing. I like this a lot. This is the world that the adults don't want me to know about, but I'm suddenly getting access to it. So literature for me was always a really exciting thing. And at high school, I loved writing essays, which were predominantly short stories. And I loved reading contemporary fiction, commercial fiction. But not really reading crime. My sister, who was a few years older than me, was a big fan of Agatha Christie, and I tried them, but that world meant nothing to me. It didn't speak to me. It was a very different world that she was writing about. But I got to university and arrived in Edinburgh to study. And I started walking around Edinburgh to try and make sense of the city. Now, Edinburgh is a small city, you would think. If you lived in the States, you would think it's tiny. 500,000 people. In fact, when I arrived there, I think the population was about 400,000 in 78. So you can walk around it in a day. You can walk around it really easily. It's a nice city to walk around, and if you're going to go to Edinburgh, I recommend that's how you get to know the place. But as I walked around Edinburgh, I was seeing these two cities. The city of great wealth and great culture, museums and monuments, and it was the centre of Scottish banking and the insurance industry and various other things. And church and state were all, Edinburgh was the centre for those, but it was also a place with big social problems, which eventually Irvin Welsh would write about in his book Trainspotting, which became an international sensation, and the film became an international sensation, even though I know that in the States you needed subtitles for it. Irvin told me that himself, and probably you needed subtitles for the book as well. But so there were these two Edinburghs, and in, as a student I was reading Scottish literature and American literature. I was actually specialising in American literature. But I was still fascinated by Edinburgh and by these two cities, because Edinburgh, if you know it, there's the new town and the old town. The Americans think this is very amusing because the new town dates back to the 19th century. In fact, it dates back to the late 18th century. They started building Princes Street, which is a dividing line between the old town, the original Edinburgh, and the new town. Started building that in, I think, the 1780s. And because Edinburgh had been just the old town, the castle down to the Palace of Holyrood and everything around there was the original city of Edinburgh. And it was cramped, it was unsavoury, there was a lot of disease, a lot of poverty. You had the rich and the poor living on top of each other, basically, in these tenements, these tall buildings. And so the rich decided to build their own rational and planned environment. And if you look at a street map, a plan of Edinburgh, you'll see that the new town is a grid with circuses, these kind of circular streets at either end. Very elegant, like you get in Georgian Bath as well, if you've ever been to Bath in England, these beautiful Georgian rounded streets. And it was built in a rational, scientific way, because at that time Edinburgh wanted to think of itself as a rational, scientific city. It was a centre of learning, of science, of medicine, of the law. And so the old city was this kind of crazy, chaotic, unplanned mess, this warren of narrow streets that just, and building, you know, when a building got full, they just built another story until they became totally unsafe and would crumble down. There's a famous story of one of these buildings collapsed on the Canongate, which is the centre of the old town of Edinburgh. And as they were kind of clearing the rubble, they heard a voice from below go, "Heave a wall, lads, I'm no deep yet. Keep working, I'm still alive." And so that's actually now on a stone above the alleyway, the entrance to where this building used to be. So they built the new town, and one of the residents of the new town was a very young Robert Louis Stevenson. His family designed lighthouses. They were engineers and architects. They designed lighthouses that were dotted all around the British Isles. And so he grew up in this very fine Georgian address, but he was quite a sickly child, and he would often be in bed, and his window of his bedroom looked out onto Queen Street Gardens, which are these private gardens that you only get access to if you live in that part of town, in the middle of which was a little pond with a little island on it. And he would imagine all the adventures that could happen on this treasure island. Also in his, I'm going all over the place here, but it won't make sense in the end, trust me. Like a comedian, I will get back to the original point of the story. But as a young man, he was attracted to the darker side of Edinburgh. He would sneak out of the house at dead of night and tiptoe up to the old town to consort with beggars, vagabonds, poets, prostitutes, drug addicts and drunks. So he was always attracted to the darker side of life. But he had a nursemaid when he was young also, and there was a wardrobe, a large kind of chest in his room, which had been made by a guy called William Brodie, who Stevenson's nursemaid would tell him the story of this guy who was a gentleman by day but a thief by night. There's a pub in Edinburgh called Deacon Brodie's, and it has a story of Deacon William Brodie on the side of it. So he was a craftsman, a woodworker, a gentleman, a member of society, but at night he had a gang of thieves that he was in charge of. And he would break into your apartment and steal your valuables. And it was easy for him to do because he'd often fitted the locks himself. And eventually he was found and he was hanged on a scaffold that he had built. Poetic justice, some would say. Although there is a rumour that he escaped. There is a rumour that he had a wooden collar around his neck, hidden by an elaborate scarf. And as soon as he was hanged, his henchmen came and cut him down and took him away, and that was the last that anybody saw of him. So Stevenson's nursemaid told him the story of this guy who was good and evil in the same person. And again, that gave him the seed, that planted the seed. Like the island with in the pond, it might have given him the seed for Treasure Island. So Deacon William Brodie gave him the seed for Jekyll and Hyde. A novel that he set in London, because again, partly it was based on a Scottish physician who lived in that part of London and who also consorted with body snatchers. Now, body snatchers, see, by finding out about Stevenson, oh, and by the way, that wardrobe, if you go to Edinburgh, is in the Writers' Museum. Writers' Museum is up near the castle, down a tiny little alleyway. You go in, it's dedicated to Walter Scott, Robert Louis Stevenson, Robert Burns, and the wardrobe is in the Stevenson room. So the story of Stevenson sort of took me to another Brodie, Miss Jean Brodie, who is in Muriel Spark's famous novel, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which you've got to say in an Edinburgh, a posh Edinburgh accent. And Miss Jean Brodie, you've probably seen the film with Maggie Smith, even if you've not read the book. And if you've not read the book, please do. It's only 120 pages long, but it's a gem of a book. And it's much, much bigger than its physical size would suggest. It contains multitudes. But she actually says in the book that she's descended from William Brodie. And she's a gentleman of the town. She doesn't say that he was also a thief. And that he would... I'm desperately trying not to use the word burglar, which is not a term in Scotland. We just don't have the word burglar in law. We have housebreaking and housebreaker, but we don't have burglar, which is a mistake that I made, I think, in my first book before a cop said to me, you know, that's not a term we use. I'm learning stuff all the time. We'll come back to that later. All this stuff, and you know, when you arrive in Edinburgh, if you arrive by train, you arrive at Waverley Station, which is named after Sir Walter Scott's first novel. If you emerge from Waverley Station, the first thing you see is this huge Gothic missile, it looks like, in Prince's Street Gardens, which is called the Scott Monument, and there sits a statue of Sir Walter Scott at the middle of it, and dedicated to the life of the novelist. So Edinburgh is a city where you cannot escape writers. They are all around you, in the present day and in the past. And it's a city that really has always respected the written word and respected storytelling. So there I was at university, and having finished my undergraduate stuff, I was writing poetry at that time and short stories. By the time I started the PhD in the novels of Muriel Spark, I was starting to try and write novels myself. And so I spent 3 years in Edinburgh writing about Muriel Spark and also trying to write my own work. And it was Spark who kind of took me to, through Jean Brodie, took me to Deacon Brodie, and Deacon Brodie took me to Jekyll and Hyde. And Jekyll and Hyde took me back to another book called Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. Great title, by a guy called James Hogg. And again, this was an influence on Jekyll and Hyde. This is a book that feels very modern to me. It's not an easy book to read. It's got a very difficult structure to it. But it's a book about a guy, a religious zealot, who is persuaded by a charismatic stranger that he is going to go to heaven whatever he does, and therefore he can commit murder. And the people he should try and murder will be people who don't agree with his religion. Sound familiar in the present day? You can imagine if it was somebody with a suicide vest or with a backpack full of explosives, this stuff is still going on. What we're never sure about as readers is whether this charismatic stranger really exists, or whether he's a figment of the fevered imagination of this young religious zealot. Because this stranger seems to be a shapeshifter, and he seems to sometimes disappear, and sometimes he looks just like the kind of anti-hero of the book. So it's a really extraordinary, complex piece of storytelling about morality But it's also one of the first serial killer novels, because our hero goes off and starts killing people and getting away with it. So all of this stuff was kind of swimming around in my head in a kind of soup. But there was no tradition of the crime novel in Scotland. Now, having said that, there were crime writers. Just recently, I was asked by someone who runs a literary festival in Auckland, New Zealand. She said, look, we're bringing a party of friends of the festival over to the UK. We're going to bring them to Edinburgh. Would you take them on a walking tour of literary Edinburgh? And I said, yeah, sure. It was the middle of the festival, which is August, so the place is packed out with tourists. I said, how many? She said, 26. Oh, Jesus God. Because the streets are really narrow, the sidewalks are really narrow, there are people everywhere. I thought, I'm going to lose them. I'm going to lose at least half of them. So I devised a kind of route, which would take us around the new town, which is actually much quieter. Most of the festival doesn't happen there. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll meet you at the top of Leith Walk at the Sherlock Holmes statue. Because Sherlock Holmes was invented by Arthur Conan Doyle, and Arthur Conan Doyle was born and brought up in Edinburgh. So Rebus, although he's quite famous now as a character, my detective, will only ever be the second most famous detective to come out of Edinburgh, because he's never going to be that. Anyway, so I went to the top of Leith Walk to find the reason we put a statue there is because we knocked down the house where Conan Doyle was born to build a roundabout, a generator. Years ago, it's like, you know, a lot, many decades and decades ago. And only afterwards did anybody think, whoops. I mean, we also knocked down what was Scott's childhood home. It's where the university is now. So we never used to respect our writers quite as much as we do, or at least the city council didn't respect writers as much as they do now. But when I got there to the site of Conan Doyle's childhood home, where this statue now is next to a generator, it wasn't there. They'd taken it down for roadworks, so they could do some roadworks, do some drainage. So where's the tour group? Luckily, Edinburgh and Scotland also a place where you find many bars, and there's a bar right across the road called the Conan Doyle. So that all the tour group were there going, where's the statue? Where's the statue? So that was a mystery. That was a 3-pint problem for me. Had to be said. But all the time I was a student, I really wasn't aware of Conan Doyle as a Scottish crime writer, because he left Scotland pretty much as soon as he left his university studies, and he moved to England, and he decided to set his stories in England, and Sherlock Holmes is seen as being a very definitive English detective, not seen as being a Scots detective. And there was no tradition of the crime novel in Scotland. What we had was these very dark, gothic, moral, psychological thrillers, things like Justified Sinner and Jekyll and Hyde, with a whole range of these quite dark books in which terrible things happen, but not structured as mysteries per se, not structured as crime stories. There was no Agatha Christie, there was no Dorothy L. Sayers, there was nobody like that who were giving a whole generation of writers a way of writing a crime story. And then in the 80s, a bunch of writers at much the same time came along who all thought, well, you know, we've studied literature and stuff, but we want to write crime fiction. And for various reasons, we decided on crime fiction. So there was Val McDermott and me, came up at much the same time, and a few other writers as well. And in fact, Val I hadn't met until that same VoucherCon in Seattle. That was the first time we actually physically met, although we'd been corresponding for a while. But this is a generation of writers who decided they could use the crime novel as a way of looking at society, as a way of dissecting society from top to bottom. A detective, a police detective, allows you access to the very top and the very bottom of society. So it's a very useful, Rebus, the detective, was a very useful means for me to look at the politics, look at the social issues, look at the culture, look at the past and the impact of the past on the present, etc., etc. And so it was a great way to explore the city of Edinburgh, but also to explore the psyche of Scottishness and what makes the Scottish character. Problematically, there's very little crime in Scotland. Some of you will know there's no guns, or almost no guns. There's very little armed crime, very few shootings. Until recently, very few police officers carried guns. There used to only be one police patrol car in the whole of Edinburgh that had a gun in it. It was kept locked in the glove box And if you wanted to take it out, you had to phone a senior police officer and ask permission to unlock and take out this weapon. Now there are two or three, but for a while there were only one. And it's still not needed very often. Frustratingly for crime writers, the crime rate is quite low. So what we always say is we're talking about the potential for these things to happen. We're talking about the potential for crime to happen. But these are writers who I think a couple of generations ago, people like Denise Mina, Louise Welsh, a couple of generations ago would have been trying to write literary fiction. They would have thought of themselves as literary authors. What's happened is the lines have blurred, and there's not nearly the kind of the us and them sense that there used to be of populist fiction, of popular fiction being a lesser form. So now in the UK you can study crime fiction at universities, other people write their PhD theses on my books, which is slightly odd. And in high school as well, you can sometimes do your English essays on crime novels by Scottish writers. And even writers who you don't think of as crime writers, like Kate Atkinson, who lives a quarter of a mile from me in Edinburgh, sometimes writes private eye stories set in Edinburgh. And a lot of her books are structured as mysteries. And then, of course, J.K. Rowling,
yes,
who lives in Edinburgh, has done for years, has turned to crime fiction, and thankfully sets her books in London. I was going to have words with her if she'd set them in Edinburgh. And my next door neighbour, book one, who some of you will have, you definitely have heard of, and you might even have met, Alexander McCall Smith. We live two houses apart on the same street, and have done for 15 years. And this is, this kind of throws something into sharp relief, which is that it's a very broad church, Scottish crime fiction. It can take really dark stuff, very, very dark writers, but also Mama Remote's Way. This can all be contained because there is no school, there is no tradition of crime fiction in Scotland, so we feel free to do whatever we want. Books set in the past, books set in the future, cops, private eyes, you name it, gentle books, hard-edged books, gothic books. We can, no writer feels under a certain constraint to write a certain kind of book, which is fantastic. There was a time, it was a short time, but there was a time when I'd go to the local cafe in the morning, yes, it's a Starbucks, and Sandy McCall Smith would be sitting at one table and Joe Rowling would be sitting at another, and I would be there. And in fact, one time, my editor came up from London and we'd arranged to have a meeting, so we went in Starbucks, and he said, "Oh my God, J.K. Rowling sitting over there." And she had her headphones on, iPod, she was scribbling away. I think at the sixth or seventh Harry Potter book she was writing at that time. And then my editor kind of froze. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "She's gone to the toilet." I went, "Yeah, she's left the manuscript on the table." I went, "Yeah, this is Edinburgh, I'm not just going to steal it." I thought, "Well, maybe though, maybe we should." that was my chance. But anyway, he went and stood guard to make sure nobody did steal the sixth or seventh Harry Potter book, so that it would be released into the wild. Jo did eventually move across town. She lives on the other side of Edinburgh now, because she couldn't take the pressure of living beside me and Sandy McCall Smith. I never did finish the PhD on Muriel Spark, but she was a huge influence on me in lots of ways, and she did write one of the more extraordinary crime novels I've ever read. A tiny, tiny book, it's only 90 pages long, I think, called The Driver's Seat, which was made into a terrible film with Elizabeth Taylor many years ago. Filmed in Italy, I think, with a cast who couldn't really speak English, so they were being dubbed into English. And she was saying her lines in English, but they were sending back in Italian and stuff. And, one of those weird European co-productions. But The Driver's Seat is an extraordinary book where I'm not giving much away by saying it's basically somebody looking for somebody to kill them. And is that person in the driver's seat or the passenger seat when it comes to their life? And I must have read that book a dozen times. And Muriel Spark was one of these writers who did use the Gothic and did use ballads. She was a huge fan of the Scottish Border Ballad, these poems that are usually about horrible things happening, and spectres and ghosts and supernatural, and a lot of cheating on each other and a lot of murder. And Robert Louis Stevenson equally was a big fan of the ballads. And so from research and Spark, I'd learned quite a lot. And it was a thrill to meet her. The year before she died, I met her at the Edinburgh Book Festival and was able to sit with her for a few minutes and get her to sign my first edition of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And then she went and died. And this year is the centenary of her birth. So there's been a lot happening in Edinburgh to celebrate the centenary of Muriel Spark's birth, including naming two streets after her, and or one after her and one after Miss Jean Brodie. There was a festival, a play put on her, the only play she ever wrote has been produced, and a couple of TV documentaries, one of which I've made. I came into crime fiction not really knowing much about it. And so there was no model to follow, but the people that I really liked were the American crime writers. I came here in 1992. My first Rebus novel was 87. And I came here in 1992 for the first time on a Chandler Fulbright scholarship. This was money given by the estate of Raymond Chandler so that a crime writer from the UK could come to the States for a minimum of 6 months and really get to know the country. So it was a fantastic, and I'd applied once before and I didn't win it. So the following year, it was an American writer who went to the UK, and then the year after that, I applied again, and this time, maybe I was the only applicant, I don't know. But I won, and so I came to the States for 6 months, and really started to devour American mystery novels, and very quickly became a big fan of Lawrence Block. I loved Matt Scudder. So much so that the villain in the Matt Scudder books, Mick Ballou, I based the character of Cafferty, the villain who runs Edinburgh, the gangster who Rebus has a kind of friendship with or an empathy with, I based him on Mick Ballou very heavily. And I've told Larry Block that, I make no bones about it. And basically also anybody called James, so if you're called James Elroy, James Lee Burke, James Hall, James Salas, there's a chance I was going to read your books. Sarah Paretsky, of course, and a bunch of others. And what I liked about the American crime story that I didn't get at that time from the UK crime story, the English crime story, the traditional English crime story, was a sense of urban grittiness. A sense that this is what the city is like, and that human beings have the capacity for all these things. That Muriel Spark said this as well, she said human beings have the capacity for great good, but also for evil. And so, I found very quickly, yes, these are my people. And I found my milieu. This is what I want to write for the rest of my life, is crime fiction. And I got to know a few cops. When I was writing the first Rebus book, I went to talk to I wrote to the chief of police in Edinburgh. I was a PhD student. I thought, how do you find out about the police? I'll write to the guy at the top. And he directed me to a police station in Edinburgh and said, go and talk to these two detectives. I duly turned up looking like a tramp. And they said, what's your book about? And I gave them the plot of the first Rebus novel, Knots and Crosses. And not knowing that they were investigating a crime that was almost identical. Because I didn't read the news. I didn't know this. So I became a suspect in an ongoing police inquiry that ended up with seven murder victims. And he got the guy eventually. His name was Robert Black. So I wasn't a suspect for very long. But after that, I didn't go near the police for years. Until a cop came up to me at a signing I was doing, at an event I was doing in Edinburgh, and he said, I like your books, but you make a lot of procedural mistakes. So he became a friend, and he helped me out a lot to make sure that I got the details right. And by that time, I was no longer a PhD student. I was now married, and I was working, and I was heading towards writing being a full-time job, a career. And I did feel if I was going to make a living by writing about these people, these professional people, I owed it to them to get the details of their jobs as right as I could make them. I still make a lot of mistakes, but there are people I can talk to try and get the details right. It doesn't help that they keep changing the goalposts, as we say in the UK. You know, the way the police investigate murders in Scotland has changed out of all recognition, not just because of the technology that's come along, but they just changed the structure of a murder inquiry. And that's really problematic, because I've got to explain that to my readers without boring them all to tears, that the way that Rebus would have investigated a murder is no longer the way it's done. There's now a kind of specialist team who will be parachuted in to wherever the crime has happened and will take over, and the local detectives will become secondary characters in that operation. But yeah, somewhere along the way, I became a full-time crime writer, and crime started to get respectable. Go figure. Because we always thought of ourselves as the kids from the wrong side of the tracks, you know? We were never going to win the Pulitzer or the UK equivalent, the Booker Prize. We were never going to get shortlisted for it. But hey, in the last couple of years, crime fiction has started to get shortlisted and longlisted for the Booker Prize. In fact, last year, shortlisted book, His Bloody Project, by Graham McRae Burnett, Scottish writer, which is hugely influenced by Confessions of a Justified Sinner. McRae Burnett would tell you that. If you read those two books, you'll see the connection between them. There's another writer that I've not mentioned, and I really should, and that's a Scottish writer called William McIlvany, who was a huge influence on that generation, including me, Val McDermott. McIlvany had come along just before us, and he was a literary novelist. He was a literary author. He'd won various literary prizes. He wrote poetry. He wrote essays. But he'd also written three crime novels, great crime novels, set in Glasgow with a detective, quite a philosophical detective called Laidlaw. And they were kind of hard-boiled, and they were American style, and they were noir, and they were urban, and they were about contemporary social issues. And so a lot of us looked at him and went, oh, so it's okay. Crime fiction is okay. It's okay to write crime fiction. And I remember in 1985, at a book festival, I went up to McIlvany and said to him, I'm writing a book that's a bit like Laidlaw, but set in Edinburgh. That was the first Rebus novel. And he wrote in my book, he said, good luck with the Edinburgh Laidlaw. He actually wrote it in the book. I met him 20 years later, and he wrote in the book I got him to sign, Edinburgh Laidlaw did okay. I think he was kind of kicking himself that he had given up crime fiction and gone back to literary fiction again, where he was making a lot less money. And wasn't getting the kudos, because by that stage, crime fiction from Scotland was where it was at and continues to be. Some of those writers I've mentioned, they've always been kind of outliers. They've always been crime writers in Scotland, thriller writers in Scotland, Helen McInnes. We've got Josephine Tay. Yeah, Josephine Tay lived in Inverness most of her life, way up in the north of Scotland. Really interesting character, and has been used as a fictional character, I know, in a recent crime novel. But she's, you know, been kind of forgotten about, that she was Scots. And of those thriller writers I was talking about, The 39 Steps, John Buchan. John Buchan was a Scottish novelist and who specialised in the thriller. So there were these kind of outliers. Alistair MacLean, oh my God. My dad and I used to devour Alistair MacLean books. All these thrillers that were written in the 60s that got turned into big Hollywood movies, Ice Station Zebra, and Where Eagles Dare, Guns of Navarone. All these American action heroes running about in books, in films based on books, written by a native Gaelic speaker. He grew up in the Western Isles, where President Trump's mum came from, and he was brought up, or as a child he was speaking Gaelic. He wasn't speaking English. Well, it had become a huge bestseller. So there were these outliers, but I think it was good for a lot of us that we didn't feel like we were stepping in the footsteps. We weren't in the footsteps of the shadow of somebody like Agatha Christie or Marjorie Allingham or Dorothy L. Sayers, because it gave us a bit more freedom to write the kinds of things we want to write. And that continues to be the case to this day, and there's a whole new generation. I mean, Val McDermott and me and a bunch of others from our generation, we're now the old guard. You know, we used to be the young Turks, now we're the old guard. And there's a whole bunch of much younger writers coming up who are doing great things with the crime novel and taking it to places that are new and interesting and exciting. So it continues. So suddenly Scotland has become the kind of go-to place for crime fiction. And often compared favorably with Scandinavia, same kind of darkness, well, physically, same darkness, you know, like 9 months of the year. I think that's why Scots are great readers. We never get weather like this. So we just sit indoors all the time beside the fire reading books. You know, this is, if I go outside now, I'll melt. I'll spontaneously combust. I'm not joking. This is ridiculous. We had a heat wave this summer. A heat wave. It got to 71. Yeah, I know. You go, oh, lucky. Oh. Has anybody got a question? Well, I just pause for thought and maybe take a drink of water. Has anybody got a question? How long have I been going, by the way? Oh, I've been going a while. Yes, sir.
I love the Laidlaw books and can you talk about, is there, you know, there's very little crime, you say, but can you talk then about the tradition of drinking?
Can I talk about the tradition of drinking? How long have you got?
When I finished those Laidlaw books, I felt hungover. That's what I loved about it. And I was just wondering, just your impressions of it. We have a tradition of drinking in Alaska that leads to a lot of crime.
Sure. Yeah, and I mean a lot of the crime in Scotland, a lot of the physical crime, crimes against the person, would be under the influence of drink, more than drugs, but it'd be drink. A lot of domestic violence, as we call it, that lovely euphemism for beating up your spouse or partner. Alcohol's at the root of a lot of it. It's a lot of the root of a lot of social problems. When I started writing the Rebus books, I thought Rebus will be a drinker. That's the kind of tradition, you know, he's almost like the private eye with a bottle of scotch in the bottom drawer of his desk. I thought that would be Rebus. He's a bit of a dinosaur. Even in the first Rebus novel, he's been around for a while. He's an old-style cop. And as the series progresses, you see that he's surrounded by cops that don't do that anymore. And I was finding that true in real life. I mean, I started drinking at a bar called the Oxford Bar. It's a real pub in Edinburgh. The first time I walked in there, it was all cops. All cops. And they would drink during the day, they would drink at lunchtime, they would go in after work of an evening and stay there till late at night. That no longer goes on. That drinking culture amongst police officers no longer happens the way it used to. So Rebus is an anomaly in the fact that he still lives like that. Most cops don't. But for him, the kind of pub is just a place he goes to for, he gets information there, he feels safe there, he can take meetings there, all kinds of reasons for him to use it. And he can let off steam a little bit. And the Rebus Bar, I mean, the Oxford Bar, you know, it's interesting because people now make a pilgrimage to the Oxford Bar and they're looking for Rebus, they're not looking for me. And I always feel I'm kind of letting them down when I'm not sitting there drunk with a kind of empty whiskey glasses everywhere, you know. And in the early days, I thought fiction had to be fictitious, so I didn't name the Oxford Bar until quite well on in the series. And I was living in France when I started to do that, and I misremembered it and put a little foot rail at the front of the actual bar that didn't exist. And so people would say, I've just been to the Oxford Bar and you describe it on this little foot rail to rest your foot on while you're drinking. There isn't one. Why did you make that? And I just forgot. So God bless him, the owner has now installed a foot rail. And he keeps saying he's going to send me the bill to pay for it, but he hasn't done so far. But yeah, the drinking thing is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I quite like the fact that I like a detective who has human failings. They're not perfect, and a lot of real life cops. Now, if there's any in the room, I apologise, but they're quite boring these days. They're quite boring. They're aware that everywhere they go, there'll be somebody with a phone or a camera phone or CCTV. So, you know, they can't do the stuff they used to get away with. And they wouldn't even try and do the stuff. And they don't want to do the stuff they used to get away with as well. There's been a huge cultural change in the way that stuff is frowned upon. Everybody's getting very kind of politically correct. So a lot of the stuff that Rebus would have been thinking and doing back in the 80s, a cop like him wouldn't do now, or certainly wouldn't get away with it for very long. But I think, you know, I wanted him to have some problems, I wanted him to have some human failings, and I like a drink. So I've got to say that in some respects, he and I have got the same DNA. You know, our taste in music and our taste in booze are pretty much, I've never smoked, and he smoked most of his life. He stopped in the last couple of books. My wife told me he had to stop.
McIlvany himself?
He did drink until fairly late on in his career. I think he stopped for health reasons. He smoked pretty much all his life. There was a lovely thing that happened. Lovely, is it? Was it lovely? He was at the Edinburgh Book Festival quite a few years ago, and someone asked him about the Laidlaw books, and he said, they're no longer in print. And it was true. They were no longer, you couldn't get them. And a small Scottish publisher called Canongate, that's the name of the company, based in Edinburgh, were in the room, went up to them afterwards and said, we would love to put those books back out again. So they got the rights, and they got as many Scottish prime writers as they could to give them a quote for the books. And so there was like a rebirth of McIlvany and interest in him. And I was going to interview him at a huge crime fiction festival in Harrogate. And so we met in the green room, and it was like 9 o'clock Sunday morning. And he said, Ian, no bugger is going to be out of bed at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning to see me. I went, yeah, okay. And we walked into the ballroom of the hotel. There were 800 people.
Oh,
it was full, standing room only. And they all got to their feet and applauded him as he walked to the front.
Oh.
And I could see on his face that he was just, he was emotional. He was overcome to think this community had never forgotten him. And that people loved rediscovering him, or discovering him for the first time, quite late on in his career, as it turned out. So that was a lovely moment. Sir, thank you.
You introduced a new recurring character, the dog called Rillo. What prompted you to do that?
What prompted me to bring a dog called Brillo into the books? A lot of the books are named after songs, song titles, or misheard lyrics. And I wanted to, and there was a song by a Scottish band called The Associates, and the song was Even Dogs in the Wild. And the theme of the song is basically saying human beings treat their offspring sometimes worse than animals do in the animal kingdom. And this was a story that had abuse at its heart. I thought, that's a really good title for the book, Even Dogs in the Wild. I think the lyric goes something like, Even Dogs in the Wild could do better than this. I thought, okay, I'm going to call it Even Dogs in the Wild. Maybe I'll bring a dog in to the book. So in the second draft, I introduced this dog, and it's a stray, and eventually Rebus takes it home. And a couple of years later, I'm writing a follow-up book, Rather Be the Devil, and I show it to my wife, and she goes, where's the dog? And I'd forgotten that I'd put a dog in the previous book. So I had to bring the dog back in. And so Brillo stuck around, and Brillo's in the new book as well that comes out towards the end of this year. And it's a pain. You know, no, really, I mean, when I introduced Rebus into the world, he had no ties. He was divorced, he barely saw his daughter, he didn't really have many friends. And that was great because he could focus on the job at hand, which was taking the reader through the mystery. If you encumber him with stuff like Brillo, he suddenly got to, yeah, I'd love to investigate that serial killer, but I've got to go home and let the dog out and take it for a walk. So he's desperately trying to lay the dog off on anybody. Do you want a dog? Anybody want a dog? But Brillo's around for a while. And of course, once you introduce pets into books, can't kill them. The worst abuse I ever got from American readers was when, in one of the early Rebus novels, he accidentally killed a cat.
Oh.
And they went, no, can't do that. He didn't like the cat, so he locked the cat flap shut so it couldn't get back in from the garden, and a fox got the cat. Yeah, never do that again. So, Brillo's around for the foreseeable. Probably got time for one more, then we'll maybe stop for lunch.
Ian, you have a really interesting resume for your writing. Tell us about some of the jobs that you held, because I just love them.
Tell you about some of the jobs that I've done? Oh my God. Well, alcohol researcher is a real job. People think that's a joke. There was a study into teenage drinking habits in Scotland, and my girlfriend and I got jobs working on it. You had to basically go around to people's homes, teenagers, and interview them about their drinking, their alcoholic consumption. And they'd interviewed them at 13, 14, and they were going back and interviewing them at 16. So we were almost like private eyes, because if you went to the address and they were no longer there, you had to track them down and do the interview, or you weren't going to get paid. So it was a bit like being a gumshoe. It's quite interesting in a way. And after years of doing the research, the finding was pretty much what I could have told them it would be at the beginning, which is that teenagers lie about how much they drink. And the younger they are, the more they exaggerate how much they drink. You know? So that was a real job. Swineherd, looking after pigs. That was my girlfriend and I, when we graduated, we went to France. We had a tip that there was a place you could go and stay. It was like a commune, come vineyard, come farm, and they would feed you, and you would work there. You didn't get any pay, but you got fed, and you could just chill out and hang out. And they had, as part of the farm, they had pigs, so my girlfriend and I looked after the pigs. until I killed, well, we killed one of them accidentally, through giving it an alcohol overdose. We trampled the grapes in the old way. You know what the old way means? It means you strip naked, lots of you, and you get to these huge wooden vats. And the reason you get naked is because by the end you're going to be up to your neck in grape juice. These are huge vats. You don't just roll up your trouser leg and do this. No. So we were all in these vats and we were all drinking away, drinking wine and stuff and trampling the grapes and everything. But then what's left, the kind of lees, the pips and the skin and stuff, you're supposed to feed to the pigs because it's nutritious. But we were hungover the next day, so we left it and it was sitting in the sun and it started to ferment without us knowing it. So the next day when we fed it to the pigs, they got drunk and one of them didn't make it. So I wasn't a swineherd for very long. I mean, all the jobs I've done, you know, hi-fi music critic or reviewer and internal revenue guy sending up demands for tax when I was young, working in a chicken factory. I mean, all the jobs I did were kind of just a means of making some money so I could go home at night and write books. That was all I wanted ever to do, was write books. And look where I ended up. Not bad.
So I did want to ask Ian one other question because they still don't quite have lunch ready, so we have like 5 minutes. Okay. You have talked about Edinburgh. Tell us, Ann Cleves, as you know, has done a wonderful series about Shetland, but we haven't really talked about Glasgow last week, Jim. And what kind of a setting is it for crime compared, because it's such a different city, to Edinburgh, and are there any writers, for example, Denise, that you might pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird, and you probably would think it's weird. I mean, UK is a small country, Scotland is a small country within that. I mean, Scotland, the population, 5 million. Of that 5 million, over a million live in the two cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh, two main cities. And Glasgow and Edinburgh are only 40 miles apart. It's a 45-minute train journey between them. But the language is different, the accent is different, the sense of humour is different, the philosophy of life is different, the culture is different. It's extraordinary. I always felt to me like Glasgow was much more Celtic, much more connected to Ireland, whereas Edinburgh felt kind of Dutch almost, or Scandinavian. It felt like it was looking east, whereas Glasgow was looking west. And whether that's true or not, I'm not sure, but Edinburgh's got this reputation of being a kind of place of secrets. So banking and insurance, jobs where, you know, careers where you have to keep secrets, that's where Edinburgh does really well. Glasgow, you can't keep secrets, because strangers talk to you at bus stops and want to know who you are, where you've come from. Edinburgh people will never ask you questions. We're not going to stop you on the street and say, where are you from? We're too shy. So Glaswegians are very open and outgoing. And yet Glasgow's got the crime. Glasgow has the gangsters. Glasgow in the past had a lot of gangsters. It's got big drugs problems, probably, I would say, bigger than Edinburgh. It has, of course, connectivity to the Irish situation. So a lot of gun running, a lot of money raising to send money to terrorists in Northern Ireland so they could buy weapons. All that stuff was going on. And you did get quite a gritty crime fiction came out of Glasgow, and Mark O'Vanney, of course, was the godfather of it. Denise Mina came along and has written much more complex psychological novels in which crime sometimes does happen. Her latest book, The Long Drop, is it published in the States? Long Drop?
I think so.
Yeah.
Our Denise Mina's already.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary book because it's very much based on a real life case of a kind of killer from the late 50s and a night that he spent with a guy whose family he had killed. And the guy suspected this was the guy who'd done it. And it's true, they spent an evening together as the guy was trying to find out if this guy really tried to get him to confess that he had killed his wife and daughter. And eventually the killer was arrested and dismissed his defense attorney and conducted his own defense and was eventually found guilty and hanged. But it's an extraordinary, it's almost like In Cold Blood, it's an extraordinary piece of fiction. It's a really interesting push into a kind of slightly different area for crime. But what has happened is that suddenly everywhere around Scotland, all the small towns, all the islands have decided, hey, we should get into this act as well. Because crime fiction has this extraordinary sense of place. So to find out about Shetland, read Anne Cleves' books. You want to find out about the Western Isles, you pick up a Peter May book. There are crime novels set in Stirling, crime novels set in Dundee, crime novels set in Borders. Katrina McPherson, set in books in South West Scotland sometimes. It seems like anywhere and everywhere you want to go now, you'll find a crime story set there. And I love it because it tells you about the culture, the history, it gives you a sense of place. Sometimes it tells you where to go and eat, or where's a good place to go and drink, parts of town to avoid, things not to say to the locals, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I always said that when I started writing these Rebus novels, I jokingly used to say I wrote it to try and stop tourists coming to Edinburgh and messing the place up. So I was trying to scare everybody off. It didn't quite have that effect. There's now a Rebus walking tour that takes you around some of the locations in the books and also takes you to the Oxford. Well, it didn't quite take you to the Oxford Bar because the Oxford Bar never used to like tourists coming in.
Yeah.
So it would sort of drop you off outside and say, look, if you want to risk it, you can go in. The Oxford Bar used to be owned by a very cantankerous man who sold it to a nice man who then sold it to another cantankerous man who's mellowed. So in the early Rebus novels, you will often see mention of the rudest barman in Scotland. He now owns the Oxford Bar, but he's not nearly as rude as he used to be, except the locals who expect nothing less.
I'm not sure what a combi of that actually might be, but that's hilarious. I also wanted to mention to you that there's a lot of wonderful historical fiction about Scotland. We could go all the way back to like Macbeth, for example. And the border country of Scotland was really just like the Western United States. It was full of reavers and a huge back and forth. There's a wonderful series by an author named P.F. Chisholm, who's actually Patricia Finney, and some of the books that Sir Robert Carey is a real historical figure. And they're just fabulous. They're centered in Carlisle, and it brings in James VI and so forth. And interestingly enough, and we'll finish up with this, I just edited her newest book, which is coming out in December, and she points out that Carey says to the reavers who've made a lifetime, generations, have gone back and forth doing border raids and stealing horses and behaving just like, you know, out here in the West, that if James becomes King of England when Elizabeth dies, the border will close and it will become one country. And their whole generation's lifestyle is gonna go south. And so you ask yourself, I wonder why one of the reavers didn't take out James VI before he went to London, which I think is an idea for a novel. Right?
It does.
So do you have any historical Scottish fiction that you would recommend?
I mean, I'm not a big one for historical novels. I try them, but I don't know, it didn't quite work often with me. I do like writing historical plays.
Right.
I've written two radio plays for the BBC set in 18th century Edinburgh, featuring a guy who's like a private eye. He's, you know, in golf, you have a thing called a caddy. Well, the caddy used to be a guide. I mean, the original term was a guide who would take you around Edinburgh. So if you were a stranger, if you were a visitor, this person with local knowledge would meet you from the stagecoach and take you around so you didn't get mugged, you didn't get attacked, you didn't get ripped off at your landlady's lodgings or whatever. And they were called caddies.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a couple of plays, and there's a long, short story about it as well, with this character called Cullender, who's a caddy, who's a guy who takes you around Edinburgh. I'm just trying to think, I mean, you know, His Bloody Project, although it was an extraordinary book, but what I really liked about it was the connection between that and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. There are plenty of books set in the 50s and the 60s. There's a guy called Alan Parks,
right,
who's just started writing very McIlvany-style crime fiction set in the Glasgow of the 1960s.
Who's Alex George? Alex George?
I don't know Alex George. But there's also another one, is William McIlvany's son, Liam, who mostly lives in New Zealand these days and teaches at university in Dunedin, which is the Edinburgh of the South. He's written a book called The Quaker, which has just come out in the UK, which is very heavily influenced by a real case, Bible John. And Bible John was not only an influence on Black and Blue, he was a character in Black and Blue. This was a real life serial killer who operated in Glasgow in the late 60s. Well, Liam McIlvany's new book is set in the late 60s and is very much, although he calls him The Quaker, rather than calling it Bible John, the crimes are identical. So this seems like a new thing that people are actually, between that and Alan Parks, people are starting to look at the Industrial Scotland, before the industry, the heavy industry all declined, looking at the way Scotland used to be, perhaps as a way of showing up where Scotland is headed in the future.
Ooh.
And we've had a lot of talk over the past couple of days about, you know, writers trying to make sense of the world and the changes that have taken place in the world very rapidly. People say to me, when are we going to get the big Brexit novel? And I don't think you can do that until the dust has settled. It has to have happened in time. I mean, I'm not a science fiction writer. I'm not a fantasy writer. I can't predict what's going to happen. But once this stuff has happened, then I think we'll start to get the novels explaining why that happened. I'll give you an example of that in real life, which is that in Northern Ireland, there was no crime fiction, hardly any crime fiction at all in Ireland, specifically in Northern Ireland, until the Troubles had ceased, or at least calmed down. And then it was a flood of crime novels. You might call it an explosion of crime novels, trying to explain what just happened. And one of my favorites is a guy called Adrian McKinty, who lives in the States.
He lives in Australia.
Does he live in Australia?
Yeah.
Oh, right. He's lived in New York for a while. No, you're right, he does. He lives in Sydney. I saw him in Sydney last. Yeah, I'm getting confused. But his books take place mostly in the 80s, at the height of the Troubles, and feature a Catholic cop. And they're and he's just signed a new 3-book deal, I think, for more of them. So they're really good historical, recent history, explaining to you the Troubles and why it happened. And maybe as a warning to history, saying, let's try not to let that happen again. Although with Brexit, anything is possible.
True. And I think on that note, we should probably quit before we spring into politics again. Let's give everyone a round of applause.
Thank you.